I next met with Dr. Pierre Fineau for an update on MDS and AML, and to begin, he commented on what's new and exciting in MDS.
First, we have the biology, which I think is going to be more and more important, and what is going to be, I'm not saying it's going to be routine anytime soon, but I mean the detection of gene mutations may add first, of course, to our understanding of the disease, but also they're probably going to constitute prognostic factors in addition to the more classical ones like cytogenetics, number of blasts, and so on. In particular, in relatively low-risk patients in whom you see you have mutations, and so this could tell you that you should start hypomethylating agents rapidly or perhaps even transplant the patient if he or she is young.
What have we learned in recent years about the biology of this disease? How would you conceptualize what's going on with patients who have this disease?
Well, what's happening is that there is the marrow progenitors. I mean, some of them are diseased and become malignant due to probably first gene mutation. And then this leads the cells to undergo too early apoptosis, which leads to cytopenias. That's the first step. And in a second step, there are more mutations that drive the cell towards the state of acute myeloid leukemia, which, of course, makes all the disease severity. Now, during decades, I would say, we knew little about those genes because in MDS, contrary, for instance, to acute leukemia, you don't see those reciprocal translocations that point to specific regions and genes. But now with the new tools we have that allow us to dissect very much the genome and perhaps even have, you know, whole genome sequencing, you can identify genes that cause the disease, that make it progress. And especially, we've been able to reconcile in the last 1 or 2 years the gene mutations and the phenomenon which is prevalent in MDS, which is the hypermethylation, that is silencing of the genome that probably leads to silencing tumor suppressor genes. And so that's the big breakthrough in terms of biology. And of course, we're waiting for the therapeutic applications. The first ones are the hypomethylating agents, but we need to go beyond.
This hypermethylation, is it more extensive in MDS than, you know, for example, other liquid and solid tumors?
It appears to be, for instance, more prevalent in MDS or AML following MDS than in AML that develops de novo, probably due to one or two genetic events. So it's really a different mechanism. And so it's very prevalent in that disease.
I'm curious what you say to patients, particularly an educated patient who has MDS. Do you tell them they have cancer, chronic leukemia, pre-malignancy? What do you say?
It's a big issue. I mean, there is the issue of course, reassuring the patient. On the other hand, there is the issue of the insurance companies. If it's cancer, they're more prone, or even national and international agencies that are more prone to put money on cancer. So we try to balance and say it's a pre-leukemic state that could evolve to leukemia, but not all the time.
Can you talk a little bit about how you evaluate someone who has MDS and make decision about initial treatment?
I think this is still based on the international prognostic scoring system, that is on the number of cytopenias, the percentage of blasts in the marrow, and on karyotype. Now, the IPSS is being refined, and at the last international meeting on MDS in Edinburgh, for instance, the cytogenetic definition was refined, giving more categories than previously. There are now 5 categories instead of 3, which is going to give a more precise prognostic definition in those cases. And currently, the other prognostic factors are probably not absolutely required, but I'm pretty sure mutations are coming of age and will be important in the next few years.
When you do feel that you need to treat someone with MDS, how do you go about doing it?
We largely base our treatment on the IPSS. You have, on the one hand, the intermediate 2 or high. We know the survival is short, with a median of about 15 months, and that they've frequently evolved into AML. So you need to try to use drugs that are going to modify the disease, like hypomethylating agents. Of course, transplant in the few relatively young patients. And whereas when it's slow or intermediate 1, survival is more prolonged, and at least half of those patients will die from other causes than MDS. So in those patients, trying to improve cytopenias is the main goal. And the main cytopenia is generally anemia. And we generally start by the EPO, or erythroid-stimulating agents. And then If it, in case of failure, which occurs in most patients within 1 or 2 years, we have then the other drugs, lenalidomide in case of chromosome 5q deletion, and azacitidine or decitabine can be approved in those patients, are approved in those patients in case of failure of EPO, and the other ones are currently being used in clinical trials.
What about the choice between azacitidine and decitabine? Can you kind of comment on that?
Well, this is difficult. As you know, there has been at least one study clearly showing a survival advantage for azacitidine. This has not been as clear for decitabine, and the reason, of course, could be the drugs are different, but it could be also that the schedule used in many of those decitabine trials was not optimal, and a new schedule that has recently been approved by FDA, that is every day 20 milligrams per meter squared per day, 5 days every month, may be more active and has been approved and I think is used in most youth centers. Another reason why the decitabine survival studies were not conclusive may be that the number of cycles administered was not enough in those studies. It appears that having prolonged treatment is clue to the success. And for instance, the azacitidine trial that showed a survival improvement had a median number of cycles of 9 overall and 15 in responders. And that is probably clue to the favorable outcome.
I'm sure you see a lot of patients who've been previously treated by oncologists in the community with hypomethylating agents. Any, I'm not going to say errors, but things that you see people do that maybe you do differently?
Well, I think in my view, the most important problem is probably the cytopenias you see during the first cycles. Although hypomethylating agents lead to fewer cytopenias than chemotherapy, well, MDS occur in older patients, generally older than those to whom you would administer chemotherapy. They also have had a protracted neutropenia in many of them, also neutrophil function defects. So they're really prone to infection. So you should be, especially during the first cycles, extremely careful. So, of course, it means that any neutropenic fever should be detected. You should transfuse. We also tend to administer prophylactic antibiotics. Now, if oncologists think this is a drug that's not associated with cytopenias, then the risk is, of course, to stop after 2 cycles or whatever, or perhaps too rapidly lower the dose or increase the interval between cycles. This is a relatively intensive treatment, especially in patients who start with profound cytopenias, which very often occurs in high-risk MDS.
What specific antibiotics and how exactly do you use them?
Well, we tend to use a combination. This has not been shown to be effective in prospective studies, but we used a combination of posaconazole and Tavneos in those patients. And our impression is that we have fewer infections. Now, those drugs are approved for the prevention of neutropenic fever in neutropenic patients, at least in Europe. So I think we need prospective studies there, but I think it's a major issue because first, some patients have severe disease and may even die during the first cycles. And the risk is otherwise to stop treatment or to reduce too quickly the dose. You have to say to your patients, well, you're going to have 3 months or at least 2 months where you're not going to be fine. First, the disease is going to worsen. I think that's what I say to all my patients. You're going to have platelet transfusions. The red blood cell transfusion requirement is going to increase, and you won't see anything before 3 months.
And for the responding patients, one of the questions I hear a lot from oncologists is, they start getting out past a year and getting tired of taking treatment. What about the duration of treatment, the intervals between treatment?
Well, it's of course the big issue. In Paris area, we're probably one of the only places in the world where the patients do not come to the hospital, but it's nurses that go to their home. And we never see patients saying, well, when should I stop? Or just, you know, for holidays, they want to increase the interval during 2 weeks and so on. And I think this is important. I mean, we have no response to that. Probably the longer treatment, the better. And if you can keep intervals, that's fine. But we have to be realistic and patients at some point want to increase the interval. So it's difficult to say, but it's probably one of the reasons for some relapses, I mean, stopping the treatment too early.
What about the issue of method of administration and schedule?
The survival advantage with azacitidine has been shown with 7-day cycle. Now, I know many centers use 5-day cycles or others use 5-2-2, that is stopping during the weekend and restarting on Monday and Tuesday. Well, those schedules have not been assessed in prospective trials, so we cannot say they're as effective as the original ones. The only thing we know from a randomized trial conducted by Dr. Lyons, he conducted a trial comparing 5 days or 5 to 2 or 5 to 5 at a lower schedule. And he had the same results in terms of response, but those were patients who mainly had low-risk MDS. So probably in those patients, those schedules are as efficacious as the original one. Now, for high-risk MDS, it's difficult to conclude that 5 equals 7.
What about the patient who develops progressive disease on a hypomethylating agent?
Well, the problem is we know that prognosis is very poor in those patients with a median survival of about 5 months. And currently we have, of course, limited drugs in those patients, and we tend to use clinical trials with different drugs. Clofarabine is used in those patients. Low-dose clofarabine may show some efficacy. There is the ON1910NA drug, which appears to give very interesting results in phase 2 trials as well. Histone deacetylase inhibitors may in this circumstance give some results. We're also using a drug which is erlotinib, which is a drug that's not used in this context normally, but which happens to have off-target effects in leukemic cells, and so gives some responses there. And we have trials also with erlotinib. And I think that's really the place for new drugs, and there will be many tested in that circumstance.
What about lenalidomide in non-5Q disease?
In non-5Q disease? Well, there are obviously some interesting results. So currently the drug is being mainly tested in clinical trials, and I'm sure there will be some positive results. But, I mean, it's only part of the patients. Obviously the response rate will be in the range of 25 to 30%.
Is it something that you actually use in your practice outside a trial setting?
Well, it's not approved, so we're currently participating in a trial, an international trial that randomizes lenalidomide versus placebo. Now, we're also involved in another trial which actually tests lenalidomide versus lenalidomide placebo in patients who are resistant to EPO. And there are some in vitro data suggesting that the combination, that lenalidomide is capable of restoring efficacy to EPO. So that could be interesting, and preliminary results of our trial are encouraging, and I know it's being conducted on other sites as well. So it may be a future for anemia, low-risk MDS, resistant to EPO alone.
What about the issue of lenalidomide in MDS, specifically patients with 5Q deletion?
Two main studies were conducted, one MDS-03 and the other one is MDS-04, which means now we have a lot of patients, something like 300. And we're capable of saying that probably you need a sufficient dose of lenalidomide initially, probably more 10 milligrams than 5 milligrams daily. And this is shown by the fact that more of those patients respond, more of those patients achieve cytogenetic response. And we know that achieving cytogenetic response is associated to fewer progression to acute myeloid leukemia, to more prolonged transfusion independence, and to better survival. So it appears that you don't need as much as in myeloma. 25 milligrams is too much because it's associated to major cytopenias, but 10 is probably better than 5. And indeed, this combined analysis is also able to show that the more you eradicate the disease in terms of cytogenetic response, the longer the remissions are, and the fewer the progressions to AML are, which means that probably the drug cannot be associated to progression to leukemia, as has been suspected in some cases.
One final question about MDS. Are there any questions that oncologists or fellows ask you about MDS that we haven't talked about yet?
Yes, I guess it's pretty often the issue of relatively young patients, I mean, who have lower risk MDS. And the question is, should you do a hypomethylating agent? Should you even transplant? And if you transplant, you still have the risk of transplant-related mortality. If you do not, the disease may progress. So I think that's the difficult issue. And I think in the next few years will be held by new prognostic factors, as I said, like gene mutations.
Let's talk a little bit about AML. What are some of the clinical research developments over the last year or two that you think are important for physicians to know about?
Well, this is currently a difficult disease. We're having many new drugs proposed, so-called targeted drugs, but so far none has clearly shown a clear survival advantage, either as a single agent, for instance, in AML in the elderly, where you want to say those patients are not fit for chemotherapy. Is any treatment better than just supportive care? Or in combination with the classical anthracycline plus cytarabine. So we have many pathways, we have many possible drugs, but I don't think there's any real breakthrough. There perhaps are a few exceptions. I would say that, for instance, the hypomethylating agents in non-proliferative AML appear to give very interesting results, and often you have a survival advantage without achieving CR or PR. It's a bit the same as in MDS. That is, those patients, you kind of improve cytopenias, you make them go back to an earlier stage, perhaps of MDS instead of AML, and they have more prolonged survival. Now, there are some lower dose chemotherapy programs like clofarabine, which appear promising in some patients, but we're lacking drugs that could really have brought breakthrough. My impression in the last few years is that we've been able, especially through prognostic factors like gene mutations, to better stratify patients into those who should probably be transplanted and those who should not. I mean, patients with isolated NPM1 mutation, for instance, do better with just chemotherapy than with transplant. And most of the other patients will rather benefit from transplant. Now, interestingly, in AML in the elderly, it appears that those mutations are also important. For example, it appears that those patients who can be cured with chemotherapy in the elderly are also those who have isolated NPM1 mutations. Although, of course, not all those mutated patients will be cured, but the other ones may perhaps not benefit from intensive chemotherapy. So perhaps we will have to stratify elderly patients not only on comorbidities, age, and so on, but also on markers like this, and say that those who have isolated NPM1 mutation, if they are fit for chemotherapy, may benefit. The other ones probably would benefit from other approaches. So this kind of stratification of patients is going to be important and save them, of course, improve the survival, but also save, you know, prolonged time in hospital and, of course, also money.
What are the markers specifically that you think, for example, a community-based practice should be done in patients with AML?
I think the panel, I mean, the FLAT3 duplication, in addition to karyotype, the FLAT3 duplication, CBP-alpha, and NPM1 mutation, for instance, are kind of the basis, and a few others can be used, but those are probably the main ones, yes.
For practical purposes, how do you go about managing the older patient with AML?
Well, we tend to base our clinical decision on, of course, age, comorbidities, karyotype, which is very important, and also what the patient wants to do. But I think mutations are going to be important. Last week, for instance, a patient who was, you know, 77, not too bad, but an isolated NPM1 mutation. And so we went to intensive chemo. Had he had no mutation or an abnormal karyotype, probably we would have gone to a hypomethylating agent or, you know.
He was 78?
Yeah.
No comorbidities?
No. Well, not important, but, you know, it's an issue of saying the risk-benefit. I mean, we told this patient, you know, you have a good chance to achieve CR and perhaps to have very prolonged CR and even being cured. And so it's, as usual, the medical decision takes into account many, many parameters. But those, I think, are important. It's like acute promyelocytic leukemia. I mean, you would treat a patient age 90 because you know you have drugs that are not going to lead to myelosuppression and are going to cure the patient because there are no more relapses in those patients as compared to the other ones.
So this 78-year-old man, has he begun treatment yet?
Yep.
And where is he right now in treatment?
He has achieved complete remission. Actually, it was not last week. It was 4 weeks ago.
Really? Wow. Is there an age limit where you just won't use intensive chemo?
Well, we rarely use it beyond 80 years. But once again, you have some very fit people. And if you think of markers associated with better prognosis, then I'm sure we will treat older and older patients based on those markers.
You mentioned APL. Can you comment on what we've learned over the last couple of years about that disease?
Well, I mean, it's a disease that can be cured in the vast majority of patients. We have the combination of chemotherapy and all-trans-retinoic acid. Now, we can go beyond and probably use the arsenic derivatives, especially arsenic trioxide. They can be used either as consolidation in order to reduce the intensity of especially consolidation chemotherapy in order to reduce the risk of mortality in remission, which does exist, I mean, 5% at least, or at least morbidity. And some people use it upfront without chemotherapy, especially in combination with all trans-retinoic acid. I think this could be, to some extent, difficult and dangerous because that drug, especially if you combine it with all transretinoic acid, can be associated to an important differentiation syndrome. And for centers that see one APL per year, you may be faced with a risk of reducing the current complete remission rate. So I think the US intergroup trial that was published recently was a wise approach. I mean, keeping the classical anthracycline ATRAF for induction, which where you reach a CR in perhaps 90% of the cases, and then keeping arsenic derivatives for consolidation and or maintenance. Now, in the case of APL, we've seen in the last few months many reports saying, well, the early death rate has remained very high, seeing from SEER registries and other approaches. I must say, it's not been our impression. Our impression is that diagnosis is faster and faster now. But of course, it has to be very quick, and physicians must think of APL because it's really an emergency. I'm speaking of a US report that considered that even recently the early death rate was something like 20%, which I don't think we find in our practice. I mean, biologists who are the first ones to see the blood smears should really think of APL every time. And if we do that, I think that we can reduce really the incidence of early death.
Do you think it's a delay in diagnosis or a delay in treatment?
I think it's a delay in diagnosis. Probably people don't think about it. Those patients often don't have blasts in blood. They're pancytopenic, but I don't know.
Yeah, I've had oncologists ask, you know, whether, you know, they hear investigators say, you know, as soon as you even suspect the diagnosis, you should start the patient on ATRA.
Yeah.
I've heard people say, you know, does that really, if they don't have any coagulation problems, is it really, you know, almost like an oncologic emergency? Do you view it that way?
I think, yes, any doubt should lead to the start of retinoic acid because that really rapidly improves the coagulation problem, which is not, I mean, you don't need to have a very, very low fibrinogen to start to have a coagulation problem. So it's really one of the emergency. I mean, it will be interesting to go deeper with those studies because the main one comes from the US, so we'll hear about it. So that if it indeed is the case that it will require efforts from the community and all physicians to try to avoid those deaths, because that type of acute leukemia can be cured in most cases, really.